land use. To the members in the audience, we're going to depart from the schedule a little bit. We're going to start with just a 10-minute informational on the B&B Fire Complex. Then we were going to go to Senate Bill 358, Creates Oregon Quality Jobs Board. And who's here to testify on that bill, Creates Oregon Quality Jobs Board?
There's more on your way.
Well, nobody. Okay, that's a quick hearing then. I expect that they will show up. And I wanted to give that a full hearing, which means that we wouldn't get to the balance of the bills till probably quarter till four, somewhere in that range. And I'm just kind of guessing, so you folks can gauge your schedule. But okay, I'm sorry, I'm looking at it. Yeah, I've got five people signed up on 358. And of course, then we'll get Representative March will be the first one on that. So if Mr. Keating and is it Mr. Taylor?
Yes.
If you'd like to start, that would be great. Thank you. But you can come up together. Okay, why don't you come on up, too? Go ahead.
Thank you, Senator. We certainly appreciate the opportunity of presenting to the committee. We have just concluded a three-act, full-fledged musical outside called "Fight It," "Fight It," excuse me, "Light It, Fight It, Log It," and it refers to the B&B Fire Complex. The B&B fire took place, if folks remember, it's the fire that took place in August 19th, 2003. It was approximately 2 days before George Bush arrived in town to speak to his Healthy Forest Initiative. It consisted of two fires that ignited almost simultaneously on the east side of the Cascades in the Deschutes National Forest in the Sisters Rangers District. The fires were named the Bear Butte Fire and the Booth Fire. The fires combined and were clustered together and became known as the B&B Fire. The fires were contained by September 24th, 2003, thanks in large part...
Excuse me, we just need to get your name on the record.
Oh, excuse me, I'm Joe Keating, I'm with Oregon Wildlife Federation.
Okay, thank you.
And this is Russ Taylor to my right, and he's the chief investigator for the B&B report.
Okay, thank you.
The fire was contained in September of 2003, thanks in large part to wet weather. It was a very intense fire that burned 91,000 plus acres, with fire suppression costs alone of $38,740,000, not counting the cost to the local economy. The preliminary investigation report by the Central Oregon Arson Task Force, better known as COATF, indicated that the fires were most likely caused by lightning. The COATF submitted its final report in September 2004 and again maintained that the fires were most likely caused by lightning. Oregon Wildlife Federation conducted its own investigation subsequent to the initial preliminary findings and concluded in its investigations in October 2004, and due to limited resources, we only investigated the one of the two fires, and that was the Booth Fire. But OWS investigation initiated site visits, interviewed dozens of citizens, and analyzed the lightning and weather data of the area. The findings of OWS investigation conclusively indicate that the COATF investigation is seriously flawed and that the Booth fire was most likely caused by political arson, let's just say arson, and not lightning. At the time of the fire, OWF requested that the governor's office conduct an independent investigation. That call was not heeded and necessitated our own investigation. We again today call on the governor to conduct an independent investigation into the cause of the B&B fire. If he does not, we would love to be able to enter into a dialogue with the committee to bring the possibility of opening a bill process to, again, move in a direction to call for and implement an independent investigation into the matter. I would like to introduce Russ Taylor, who is the prime investigator, and in about 5 minutes he will go through the facts that we were able to ascertain, which should have been ascertained by the COATF initially. Russ?
Mr. Keating has kindly consented to be my guest.
Could you state your own name for the record, Mr. Taylor?
Right here?
Yeah, sure.
My name's Russ Taylor.
Thank you very much.
And Mr. Keating is going to be my visual aid assistant here. Bill, why don't you stand right here and hold this up. What we have here is the prime graphic from the Fault Finder report.
Excuse me, you need to stay behind so your testimony is being recorded there. That's okay.
Haven't done this in a while.
No, that's okay. Go ahead and just have a seat there.
I'm glad I've got the laser pointer.
Okay.
What we have here is the primary graphic from the Fault Finder report from Vaisala Corporation, which runs the lightning detection network in the United States of America. And what you see here, the star right there, is the fire origin site. The little black dots all over here are lightning strikes that were recorded on August 4th. This was the lightning event in question. Around each one of those dots is an ellipse, which they refer to as a 99% ellipse of confidence. Now, had the fire origin site fallen within one of those 99% ellipses of confidence, I probably wouldn't be sitting here in front of you today. We wouldn't have much to stand on. But as you see, there isn't one of those ellipses within almost a mile of the fire origin site. Moreover, we had the data analyzed by Dr. Martin Ooman, who is one of the fathers of Lightning Detection Network, one of the top three people on the planet in this field. We have a letter from that gentleman stating, quote, "It is very unlikely that lightning struck the fire origin site, period." Okay. Give me the next graphic, please, Mr. Keating. We got the temperature and precipitation data for the year preceding, or for all of 2003 from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And what you see here in summary is that for January through July, preceding the August 4th lightning strike date, you had 3.98 inches of rain in the Sisters Ranger District. That summer was characterized by NOAA as a 50-year drought. Now, the reason this is important, I checked with a Forest Service gentleman who knows about these things. In order to have a successful lightning holdover, which is what they're alleging happened here, that it struck on the 4th and smoldered for 15 days, you have to have moisture. If you look over here, the temperature stats for July leading up, you will see a series of temperatures in the high 90s and here in the hundreds, finishing off the month of July. And that area where the lightning allegedly struck was as dry. It was so dry that if you had looked at it hard, it would have burst into flame. This is an east of the Cascade Crest forest with, as I understand it, had a fair bit of bug-affected situation in it. And, yeah, if you'll get the next... go ahead.
Just another couple minutes.
Yeah, I know. We're going to finish it up here. I understand. Thank you very much. Okay. If you look very carefully at the COATS preliminary report, they say that the reason... basically give three reasons why it was unlikely to be arson and more likely to be a lightning holdover, having to do with what they say is that the fire origin site, which is right here, okay, is basically too remote, too difficult to reach, etc. Well, here's the main highway, the 20 road, right here. Here's the parking lot for the Pacific Crest Trail. In November of 2003, I hiked with another 50-something male over Snowy Slope. It took us 30 minutes to reach the fire origin site from here. And this is preposterous to say that this is a remote, difficult-to-reach site. One other thing. You can see the fire origin site from the 20 road right at this point. And we have to believe, too, that we had a fire smoldering for 15 days, the most heavily traveled time of the year on this road, and a lot of people very anxious about fire in those forests at that time of year, that nobody saw it for 15 days.
Thank you. Does that, any questions from the committee? Senator Beyer.
I'd like to get someone give me some of your credentials as to what makes you and your organization more, I guess, accredited to determine what struck a fire versus, and I don't know who the Central Oregon Arson Task Force is, but I assume they are have some credentials to stand by. I'd like to have some of your credentials.
Well, I'd like to answer that in a precise way. We're environmentalists who are very familiar with the forest. We do not have a background in investigation. But what we have found here through just our own private citizen involvement, serious flaws with what the COATF came up with. The governor's office themselves indicate that they were wrong. The COATF report was seriously wrong in terms of the location of the remoteness of the area, which is the main reason why the COATF thought and concluded that it was an accidental lightning-started type of situation. Number two is the COATF itself is made up of interests within the U.S. Forest Service, Oregon Department of Forestry, and in our estimation, and then this is opinion, have a certain amount of conflict of interest in reviewing and being clear in terms of the outcome of that report. We don't have proof to that, but it's enough for us to question what happened, and what we have found is that that report, on a factual basis, despite our love of the forest and our need to protect the land point of view, is wrong. It's just factually wrong. You and I could go out on that path and in 20 to 30 minutes get to the point of origin and light a fire in a bone dry forest. And the report itself did not reach a conclusion, in our opinion, that is justified from any type of reasonable man test or woman test.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I take exception to saying that you say those are facts. I don't believe those are facts. I believe those are your opinions that fire in this report was flawed. And in fact, I would argue that if the Department of Forestry, and you said they are on the Central Oregon Arson Task Force, they would have every incentive to prove the fire was arson caused, because if it was arson caused or man caused, they would be able to recover costs to fight the fire. As it was, the Department of Forestry did incur costs to fight the B&B complex fire, and if those fires are caused by lightning, they have no ability to recover costs on those fires.
I could only respond that every possible economic incentive, all right, is now in place based upon, again, these are federal forests, all right, based upon the Healthy Forest Restoration Act, to create economic incentives to light fires, to fight fires that are lit, and then to log those fires that have been lit and fought. Right now, as we speak, the 90,000 acres in question here are being packaged for sale underneath the rules and guidelines of the emergency provisions of the Healthy Forest Restoration Act, which is just the act that President Bush was touting 2 days before the doubled plumed fire took place. I draw your attention to the fact that the facts that we presented here today in terms of lightning, in terms of weather, in terms of proximity, are facts. Those are hard facts. And the incredible thing that took place was not only did that happen in one situation, it happened simultaneously in two fires 4 hours apart. I ask you, as a reasonable person, what conclusions can be drawn from the facts that we have, except that it's probably arson. And if it is probably arson, then it's probably a felony. If it's probably a felony, it needs to be investigated just like any other felony or probable felony is investigated. And that's what we're calling for. We're not pointing the fingers at anyone. All we're saying is, hey, look at the facts, and that gauge goes from probably accidental lightning directly right on over to highly probable arson. Given those change of gauge, you add one and one together, you get two. And we're calling for an investigation.
Thank you. Chair. Well, we have a lot of people in the room. We've got a lot of other bills.
Mr. Chair, you brought in an unscheduled public hearing. And now you don't want me to ask questions about it?
Senator Beyer, if you want to ask questions, I give you all the 2 hours.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to point out that you said that your circles there are 99% accurate. That means they are not 100% accurate.
That's correct.
So how can you say those are facts, that it could not be arson or could not be lightning?
Well, no, we are not saying in total. That 1% factor, all right, is included in the word probable arson. We're not saying arson. We're saying probable arson that needs to be investigated. Now, that's a different thing than saying this is arson. Probable arson allows for that 1%, 1 out of 100% chance that it happened. But keep in mind, when you have that 1% chance that it happened, it not only happened once, it happened twice, simultaneously within 4 hours. That increases the probability factor tremendously.
Mr. Chair, I would say it increases the probability factor, yes, because we had the same lightning effect, went through the same part of the forest on the same day, and the fact that there were two fires caused by that led to more credence to the fact that it wasn't arson.
Oh, if I can only come back to you, I'm going to come back to you and say that you have to remember that what happened here didn't happen that day. What's being alleged by the task force that it happened 15 days prior and then smoldered in a bone dry forest simultaneously in two spots.
Hang on a second. Senator Beyer, I want to give you full opportunity. But when you're done, then we'll move to the other bills.
Mr. Chair, that's fine. We're done.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from the committee?
Thank you very much.
Appreciate your coming. We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 358. Representative March, could you see if Senator Ferrioli is...
2 months.
Yeah.
Booth. Yes, he does. Part of the
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Ringo, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve March. I'm a state representative from House District 46. I'm looking forward to to Senator Ferrioli joining us as we co-sponsored the Quality Jobs Bill in the last session. Senate Bill 358 is an important piece of legislation. And I want you to kind of look beyond for a second the Quality Jobs Board, because the real key here is not a board about jobs. The key is having the natural resource agencies take a look at what they're doing now with a multitude of contracts and determine what could be done and what could be bundled together into one contract by watershed using a stewardship model that would provide not only stable, quality, year-round living wage jobs, but also do it in a more efficient and effective manner. These could work with existing contractors, could work with existing watershed councils, and they would provide training and retraining of people to elevate their skills and provide quality jobs on the ground and for a sustainable period of time. And with that, I will just end my testimony and see if there's any questions.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's go to Ed Glad. And Ed, do you have somebody you want to come up with you? And we may bump you if Senator Farioli arrives. That's okay.
Understood.
My name is Ed Glad. I'm with the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters. Thank you for hearing this bill today. This is the third legislative session that we've been able to entertain this concept of quality jobs in the woods. I'm looking over my shoulder if Senator Farioli walks in. He's actually quite capable of encapsulating this in a short amount of time. I'm just going to take the role here of introducing a couple of folks who have been working in this field for quite some time. To my left, your right, is Denny Scott, who works with the Western Council of Industrial Workers, and Jennifer Hempel.
Yep.
Hempel is from the Coquille Watershed, and to my right, James Johnston, who works with Cascadia Wildlands Project out of the Eugene area. These folks have been working quite some time in the restoration industry to be able to bring back some watersheds as well as some indigenous forest landscapes to control some erosion issues as well as restoring oak savannas or what have you, and so I'm going to turn it over to Jennifer first, because she's coming from the longest distance from Coquille, and I think that she's got kids that she needs to take care of. Introduce yourself, Jennifer.
Thank you. I'm Jennifer Hempel. I'm the coordinator with the Coquille Watershed Association. I've been coordinator there for about 10 years, and the Watershed Association is unique in the fact that we are able to maintain a full-time restoration crew. 9 employees, the restoration crew workers that work for the Watershed Association, through contracts with federal, state, local agencies, as well as grant funding, we've been able to maintain the crew year-round employment at family wage jobs with benefits. So the crew on average makes about $16 to $17 an hour, which is a family wage for Coos County. It's a very high wage, actually, for Coos County. We have full health insurance benefits, paid time off. I mean, it's a regular full-time job. The Watershed Association made a commitment in the beginning to continue the Jobs in the Woods program, which originally funded the crew. When that funding started to sort of phase out, the Watershed Board sat down and said, okay, how are we going to be able to maintain this crew and keep these guys working for full-time, year-round wages? And by sitting down with some of the local agencies, other watershed councils, tribes, the county, different groups, and be able to create a work plan that doesn't just encompass summer restoration work, typical of watershed associations and you know, salmon in-stream restoration. We're able to do noxious weed eradication, erosion work, road surveys, different types of work that the agencies need done that our crew has trained to do and able to fill in that need. So I'm here to answer questions on sort of our program and how it's worked in our area that fits in with this bill. Thank you.
Am I chairing?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. I didn't know I was cheering until I looked over and he was gone. Thank you. That's fine. Next.
Go ahead.
Well, again, my name is James Johnston. I'm the executive director of the Cascadia Wildlands Project. We're a membership-based nonprofit conservation group out of Eugene. Denny and others here could speak better to the bill. This bill's impact in terms of employment and in community health. I want to speak briefly to the issue of forest health, which is my organization's principal concern. We became involved in this legislation principally because we're interested in seeing good restoration work done on the land. As anyone will tell you, the best way to get good work done is to have that work done by good workers, and that is what this bill is intended to do. There have been questions raised as to the efficiency and cost of this bill. I think that our involvement in this process speaks to just how efficient and cost-effective it is. Again, our interest is in seeing that good restoration gets done. In short, getting the maximum bang for your buck. And we're convinced after almost a decade of observing restoration work done by state, federal agencies, and by private interests, that work best gets done when we bundle contracts, as this bill calls for the investigation of bundling contracts, and it's done by high-wage and high-skill workers, that the work gets done more cost-efficiently, and that we'll ultimately be able to get more of this important restoration work done at less cost to the taxpayers. I'll leave it at that, but of course I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Go ahead.
My name is Danny Scott. Thank you. I'm with the Carpenters Union, also represent Western Council of Industrial Workers. These are workers that, during the spotted owl period, incurred large levels of unemployment. And so we've always been kind of looking for innovative approaches to keep people in Oregon employed in one way or another. This quality jobs in natural resources, I think, gives us an opportunity to look at an innovative, different way of doing contracting. It provides an incentive for the agencies to come together and define their scope of work across the landscape so that they're in a position to combine contracts, bundle contracts, look at contracting in a way that allows some innovation in a methodology that we believe ought to be tested. It ought to be tested because we believe that, one, you can do the work more effectively on the ground in some of these kinds of models, and secondly, we can create some quality employment opportunities for those in rural Oregon. This won't solve the unemployment problem in rural Oregon, obviously, but it's one of those measures that's within our grasp. It's looking at what's reasonable and what's available to us in existing expenditures that go forward by various agencies. So think of it as a concept as opposed to a board. We're interested in moving a concept whereby these agencies can come together and do sustainable restoration. It falls, it's the high road. It's looking at this work in terms of doing the work in a quality way at the same time, creating high quality jobs that pay family wages. We think that's the high road, as opposed to spiraling downward and contracting piecemeal, bit by bit, small pieces of this work that don't pay a living wage, and the quality of the work isn't always that good anyway. So with that, I'll close and open up to any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Sorry I had to step out. You haven't testified, is that right?
I did.
Would you mind waiting just for a second? I'd like to see if we can get Senator Ferrioli up here. Is that okay, Senator? Can you, if somebody could make a little bit of room for him up there.
Not that much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Ted Ferrioli, a state senator from District 30. And I don't know if I can add very much more to the testimony that I've heard here today, because it actually very accurately reflects the intent behind Senate Bill 358. But let me try to bring it down to the ground level, because that's where we need the jobs, is at the ground level. And Mr. Chairman, I can see my colleague there is looking at me and thinking that I'm the socialist from John Day, and he's right. But let me help the committee understand this from a practical standpoint. A lot of these jobs that are contracted for are jobs where a person needs particular skills and some equipment. Pickup truck, chainsaw, good pair of gloves, boots, hard hat, safety equipment, and they happen to be well versed in woodscraft, including trail building and restoration projects for environmental issues. But what we find is that the jobs that are out there usually are put out on a request for proposals, or they're bid jobs, and they tend to be in different agencies at different times of the year and scattered in a different geographic pattern across the state. So an individual that wants to try to get involved in these projects may find themselves, you know, trying to get the information online, having to go make a bid process, trying to find out where the Journal of General Circulation is, to find out where the ads are running, and then actually having to go out and look at the work, which could be in widely separated geographic areas. The other thing that's distressing is that agencies tend to operate from silos. So you've got work that's at the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and work that's at Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board and work that's at the State Department of Forestry and other state agencies, and they're all engaged in this RFP process and they're all engaged in the bid process. But when you really analyze the scope of work, it may be the same kind of work going on in a lot of different places. And using the bid process so that folks who want to participate have to go through a lot of process to aggregate enough work to have a job. And that's really all this is. If we could get the agencies to sit down with each other and do a scope of work analysis and a skill set analysis, they actually could horizontally integrate the kinds of work opportunities they have to offer, and maybe they could even offer these things across state agency boundaries, maybe by designating a lead agency, or by creating a stewardship contracting opportunity where an individual or a group of folks could do various components at different times of the year, and even a multi-year kind of a process. So the idea is, it isn't creating work that doesn't currently exist. It's just making that work much more accessible so that it can be bundled and aggregated and create an opportunity for folks that's sustainable and predictable. And those are the two features that I think are missing currently in the RFP process. We think it'll be less expensive, more efficient, and it will actually create the kind of opportunities that will let folks work in place, retain their residency in communities, and stabilize rural communities. So I think it's a pretty good idea, and I'm hoping that other members will also think it's a good idea. Quick, grab the gavel and do something, Senator Atkinson.
Yeah. Senator Farrelly, thank you for your comments. I know Senator Shields and I both appreciate them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Farrelly. Any questions for Senator Farrelly other than the wisecracks from Ash? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman. Wisecrack. Actually, I love this bill. I'm ready. I hope we move it.
Well, we haven't heard from one more. Maybe
yes,
she's. Maybe
you
she's.
Can,
oh,
here.
Oh, so you're not here to oppose. Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. I had a question for our committee administrator stepped out. Maybe one of you can. Is there a fiscal to this? And if so, how much? What are we looking at on that?
Fiscal?
I think. Okay, the answer is it will cost our state money, but they haven't prepared the fiscal yet, so we have to refer this to Ways and Means. But go ahead.
Chair Ringo, committee, fiscal impact, what we have to look at here is every year, Bill Clitting, sir, Western Council of Industrial Workers, pardon me.
That's okay.
What we have to look at here, sir, is every year this work gets done, every year the budget money is there. These crews, this crew, this pilot project will work off the existing funds that has already been used and will be used this year or next year, however long this pilot project is. That's a unique thing of this. There should be no fiscal impact. Granted, the agencies will have to work together. We have been sitting down with the agencies. We have had some meetings. We have put together some subcommittees on how to arrive at what contracts is out there.
I guess is what I'm just trying to understand. If you don't think this is good, do you want this referred to Ways and Means, or do you want this referred to the Senate floor?
Sir, I would refer that this committee take a look at this lack of a fiscal impact, and also unique thing about this bill, there is not a sunset clause in this bill, but in 2 years, our results come back to you, and you determine whether it's going to work or not. If it does not work, the program's done right there.
Okay.
I wish that you would take this to the floor for a Senate vote.
Okay. I think if I'm going to do that, I need to get permission from my leadership to get the referral to Ways and Means removed. Senator Shields.
Yeah, I heard Senator Atkinson say that he liked the bill. I like the bill as well. And it occurs to me, if the money is already being spent, the only cost, Mr. Chairman, is the cost potentially of getting people to talk to one another, which they ought to be doing anyway. Because the money is already being spent in various silos around here. They're just not talking to one another.
Okay. Thank you. Well, my committee administrator whispered in my ear as a matter of procedure that we could pass it directly to the floor, and if the Senate president doesn't like it, then he can refer it to Ways and Means on his own. So perhaps that's what we'll do. Thank you for your testimony. Is there somebody else in the audience who wants to testify on this bill? Nope. Okay, well, thank you very much. Senator Atkinson, keep your hand off the gavel, please. And let's close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 358. Senator Atkinson?
Mr. Chair, do we need to remove a referral? I don't see a referral on there.
There is a such referral.
Mr. Chair, I move that the committee
rescind
a subsequent referral to Ways and Means and send this bill to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay. Both of those concepts in that one motion, then. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And who would like to carry this? Oh, we'll have Senator Ferrioli will carry the bill then. Thank you. And let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 735, and I'm going to need the sign-up sheets on that, please. No, that was good. I actually didn't know we could remove a referral.
Yeah, at least the job here, so that's all the time.
I didn't know we could remove a referral.
We can't remove it. We can ask the Senate President to remove the referral.
Okay. But that's basically kind of what we did.
Yeah, if you want to make leadership upset, just trust us. We'll help you.
Mike Graney and Tom O'Connor, please.
We'll make it painless. Yes. Oh, she didn't bring up the phone. Do you have Greg Miller's in there?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Mike Rainey, a director of the Oregon Department of Energy, and Senate Bill 735 is the first of three bills that we requested as a result of the Governor's Renewable Energy Action Plan. The bill makes a number of changes to our energy loan program. That's a program that's financed with state bonds to fund renewable energy projects and energy conservation projects, and the low interest loans that we're able to issue are repaid by the lenders to pay back those bonds. That program has funded over $200 million in renewable energy projects since the program was started more than 20 years ago. Senate Bill 735 makes some changes that will let the program do more and make it easier to fund renewable energy projects. Specifically, it authorizes loans to intergovernmental entities. Currently, we can make loans to cities, counties, local governments, individuals, businesses, but intergovernmental entities wasn't a form that was anticipated, and we've had at least one project in Sherman County for wind development that was intending to do just that, form an intergovernmental entity and want to use a loan program. This would allow that kind of project to go forward. It would also allow projects that are partly inside Oregon and partly outside, such as some of the potential wind farms, to be funded with the loan program. It would also allow improvements to hydroelectric projects, which are currently limited to less than 5 megawatts in improvements, would allow us to make improvements greater than that. Would also make a number of technical changes in terms of bond issuance that were requested by the state treasurer and written by our bond council to bring the program more into line with other bond programs in terms of the current statutes. And finally, it would make clarification of waste eligible for energy recycling projects and clarify that sustainable building projects could also be eligible for the loan program. The bill doesn't have any revenue or fiscal impacts, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I'm just looking at the bill. What part of it allows for the loans to energy projects that are more than 5 megawatts?
Sorry.
Mr. Chairman. It's on the top of page 3, line 3 and 4, where language is being deleted. That language in italics.
I see. And I think the language was there initially, so that, I mean, to be, assuming that the big projects are wouldn't need to take advantage of the loan.
Well, Mr. Chairman, large hydro projects such as the ones on the Columbia River are well beyond the scope of this program. Typically, our loans are in the $10 to $20 million range at the most, which would be anywhere from 10 to 15 megawatts maximum. This particular provision was only applies to improvements, not to say hydroelectric projects starting from scratch. And it's kind of an anomaly there. And I, frankly, I'm not quite sure why it was put in there. And it's ended up, actually, we've had some good projects that could go forward where this has been an obstacle, that where there it would not, for example, adversely impact on fish, would increase small hydro development, meets all the other permits, and from an energy point of view, it makes sense to go forward.
Okay, thank you. Mr. O'Connor, did you have anything to add?
Just briefly, Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Tom O'Connor. I'm director of Oregon Municipal Electric Utility Association. We're an association representing the small municipally owned electric systems in Oregon. And just wanted to go on record as supporting the governor's proposals that have come out of the interim strategy on renewable resources. We're particularly interested in the change in Senate Bill 735 that allows intergovernmental entities to take advantage of this program, because that's about the only way that you're going to see the real small communities be involved in these kinds of things, is as some kind of a consortium.
Okay.
Thank you.
Could you explain just for a second what occurs in Section 2? When I read your summary says it updates the issuance provisions to match other state bond statutes. Is this giving more authority to the state treasurer, or what is this doing?
Mr. Chairman, it's... largely, the changes there in terms of the things that the state treasurer wanted don't change the authority of the treasurer. What they do is both in terms of stylistically describing the bond program and how bonds are issued is where those changes are made, and they appear throughout the bill. In a number of sections.
Okay.
The program was originally established in 1979, and our bond-related statutes themselves, part of this, have not really changed in that time, whereas okay. Other bond programs have.
Okay. Thank you. Questions from the committee? All right. Well, shall we go for it? Okay, thank you very much. Let's close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 735.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 735 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Byers moved Senate Bill 735 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 736. If you want to introduce the bill. That would be great.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 736 expands the exemption from the state site certificates currently extended to ethanol production facilities to include biodiesel production facilities. allows the use of cellulosic biomass feedstocks in such operations. Under current law, ethanol production facilities are generally exempted from the state site certification process, and this would expand that to include biomass. Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Graney?
Senate Bill 736.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Mike Graney from the Oregon Department of Energy. And as Matt said, currently ethanol production facilities are considered an energy facility under Oregon law, but there's a process for granting them an exemption if they meet certain criteria that minimize impact on the environment, including no additional transmission or pipelines, most of the material being either barged or sent in by rail to minimize traffic and local land use approval. The bill makes two important changes. Currently, that ethanol has to come from biomass that's derived from grain, whey, or potatoes, and this would also allow straw and grass and other agricultural residues for ethanol. Then it would also allow biodiesel production facilities that would, they're also from agricultural projects that meet the same criteria to apply for a exemption from the Siting Council. We provide technical staffing to the Siting Council and would verify that the facility meets the criteria that are laid out in state law. It does simplify the process for these facilities and reduces substantially the time of review for permitting and approval.
Okay. And
again, Mr. Chairman, there's no revenue or fiscal impact.
All right. Committee, any questions on Senate Bill 736? Okay. Let's close the... might as well stay up there. Let's close the public hearing. Open a work session on Senate Bill 736.
Mr. Chair, I've moved Senate Bill 736 to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Atkinson moved Senate Bill 736 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. Oh, yeah, we need carriers for 735. First of all, who wants to carry that? Senator Atkinson. And as long... Is that okay?
Sure. Chair Ringo.
Thank you. And 736 is almost the same thing. You want to carry that too?
I'd love to.
Thank you, Senator Atkinson. That's great. And let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 737. Mike Graney and Tom O'Connor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Mike Graney from Department of Energy. Senate Bill 737 authorizes state agencies to develop renewable energy and cogeneration on state property. The bill is necessary to clarify existing law that is a little confusing, and state agencies need explicit authority to undertake specific measures, according to the Attorney General's office. So the Attorney General's office told us that legislation like this would be necessary. It is straightforward. We're anticipating measures such as solar energy on buildings, but also the possibility of using wind on state property and perhaps biomass facilities in state forests to generate electricity. The bill also makes clear that if there's excess energy beyond what the state agency can use for its own facilities, it must sell it wholesale. It cannot enter into retail competition with investor-owned or publicly-owned utilities. So this does not put the state in competition with utilities. It simply provides a source of clean energy.
Okay.
And again, there'd be no fiscal impact in the bill.
In terms of, give me the practical spin on exactly what agency is going to do what with this bill.
The most immediate interest we've received is from the military department. A couple of their sites are interested in putting one or two windmills, and these would be small projects, on site for their energy needs. And these would be in perhaps three-fourths to of a megawatt to a megawatt in size. Potentially, in the future, we could see greater
use of renewable energy by state agencies, but I suspect we'll be starting small.
And the agency would consume that energy. They wouldn't transmit it to anywhere else.
This would allow, Mr. Chairman, allow any excess energy to be transmitted, but to the wholesale market, to whatever utility was willing to buy it at whatever the wholesale rate was. So it doesn't change any laws regarding wheeling or cost of power or power in the wholesale market. So if the market was very promising, you would see perhaps more of these or a larger project. If the wholesale market was the price was very low, then you wouldn't see many of these at any given time, or they would be mostly sized for the consumption on site.
Except for the military department, has somebody else expressed interest?
We've had the universities for their buildings in terms of expanded use of solar energy, Mr. Chairman. We've also State Parks is looking for a number of opportunities as well.
So are you telling me without this bill, universities can't put up solar panels?
Mr. Chairman, for photovoltaics that would actually generate electricity, there's some question. And Attorney General's office said it would be better to have a bill that makes it clear that state agencies can do that.
Okay. Committee?
Yeah, Mr. Chair?
Yes?
If a state agency wants to set up something for cogen or whatever else, will they have to come down through the Ways and Means process to get approval to fund a project, or is this the revenues from the sale continuously appropriated means they don't have to go to Ways and Means?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Barr, my understanding of the process for capital projects, which presumably this would be, is that the state agency would have to come to Ways and Means for approval of the specific project. That is true right now for the energy conservation projects that are, for example, Department of Higher Education or Department of Administrative Services comes to our loan program for major projects. They have to get Ways and Means approval. And I would expect, and this bill is not intended to change that in terms of renewable energy projects or cogeneration.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? O'Connor, anything to add?
Just again, Tom O'Connor, for the record, Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities, and we're in support of this legislation. Again, it came out of the renewable energy discussion over the interim, and we support it.
Thank you very much. Let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 737 and a work session on Senate Bill 737.
Mr. Chair, move Senate Bill 737 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Atkinson has moved 737 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 834. I don't have the sign-up sheet for our Mr. Graney. Are you? Well, maybe I do.
Have you heard this one?
No, we have not. We're getting the sign-up sheet, but Mr. Graney, are you on the sheet? Do you want to start lead off?
Again, Mr. Chairman,
the committee staff's trying to find out where I put the sign-up sheet, but. You're on it, so why don't
Hey, thank you, Chairman. Mike Graney from Department of Energy, and there are some people from Associated Oregon Counties and others who want to testify in support of the bill. They worked with us and with Dave Antoff in the governor's office on this bill, and it's intended to address a gap in developing renewable energy, especially small community projects. As to provide some funding for feasibility studies. For example, to determine if there's sufficient renewable energy, whether it's wind monitoring, whether it's geothermal, whether the water is hot enough, and to do a technical feasibility study of whether it makes sense then for the project to go forward. That is a gap because, for example, with our loan program, the legislation that you just passed, where we have projects that go forward, particularly from larger developers, they can include the cost of that feasibility study after the fact in the loan. And the project going forward will generate revenues and offset the cost of the feasibility study. Where we have people who cannot finance that feasibility study up front, again, some of the local governments that have been interested in small projects have not been able to do so. They really take a risk if the project doesn't go forward. So what this bill would do is establish a fund to fund projects, fund studies, feasibility studies for renewable energy. If the projects went forward, the fund would be reimbursed, and if the projects didn't go forward, then the loan would be forgiven. It be started with a one-time injection of lottery funds, and because of that, I have to make clear that the department does not have a position on the bill, because the funding is a budget issue, and it was not in the governor's budget. But technically, the bill is intended to address the feasibility studies, the financing of those, and that is a gap and a significant barrier in small renewable energy development projects. If the bill were passed, the bill would be we would administer the feasibility studies along with our loan program. We think we could do that without significant impact in terms of department's operations, in terms of any fiscal impact on the department.
Okay. Senator Beyer, any questions? The question, say that they can issue lottery bonds not to exceed $1 million. That's issue the bonds, or is that the revenue from those bonds is not more than $1 million?
Mr. Chairman, I think the intent of the bill sponsors is to have $1 million of funding go into the pool, into this feasibility study fund. And the source would be lottery funds, and that's because it's a budget issue. Department has no position on the funding.
Okay. Well, we'll hear from other proponents. Then any questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's hear from Alice Bibler, Paul Wooden. And are you Gary Thompson?
Yes.
Yeah, you can join him up there at the table if you'd like.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Alice Bibler with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm here to express the association's support for Senate Bill 834. This is my first time testifying, so please be gentle.
Senator Beyer, be gentle. Go ahead.
Thank you. This bill authorizes the issuance of up to $1 million in lottery bonds to loan to communities for feasibility studies for renewable energy projects. Communities are becoming innovators in this time of waning resources. Many are looking to become power producers to satisfy the power needs of their community as to enhance the local economy. Other communities are incorporating renewable energy because it's just the right thing to do. One of the major barriers to communities creating renewable energy projects is a lack of capital. In order to get capital, communities need to show financing entities that the project is viable with a feasibility study. This bill would provide the funding for that feasibility study. This bill has the potential to benefit all of Oregon. Coastal communities could harness wave power. Farming communities could produce biofuel. In southern Oregon, geothermal has great potential. Eastern Oregon has a community hydro project right now that can be implemented once funding is secured. Central Oregon is becoming a budding solar market. Wind power is just starting in Oregon and has enormous potential. And the city of Portland is a leader in green buildings and is scheduled to be 100% renewable by the year 2010. Chairman, committee members, the technology is in place, communities are willing, and financing entities will fund viable projects. If you choose to give the process the start it needs, then all of Oregon could benefit. Thank you for this opportunity to testify, and I'll answer any yes or no questions you might have.
Nice job.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Mr. Wooden.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Paul Wooden. I represent Western Wind Power. I'm a consultant working with Sherman County and in support of a feasibility study for a community wind project, partially funded by Department of Energy. I'm one of the co-authors that initiated this request. It is becoming apparent that community projects will likely spring up in Oregon in a multiple of locations, such that there would be multiples of projects in various stages of completion from initial feasibility studies through development. And the state of Oregon is excellent in funding of renewables when they become viable projects. Business energy tax program, SELP loans, energy trust funds make renewable projects in Oregon very realistic. The difficulty is getting the seed money to help a few farmers or a local community get a project to the point that it can be financed. And that's what this bill is intending to do, is to create the seed money so that it can help get authorized and pre-screened projects to the point of actual financing. And thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Thompson?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Gary Thompson. I'm Sherman County Judge. I just recently replaced Mike MacArthur, who resigned and became a member of the AOC. Basically, the only thing I have to say is this is the missing link of having a viable, renewable resource in all of Oregon. The only thing that we're missing is the being able to come up with the feasibility study money. The rest of the pieces of the puzzle are all in place at this time almost, and this is the one piece that is needed to complete not only in wind but also in all the biofuels and geothermal and wave and right on down the line. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much. I had a Tom O'Connor. Tom, did you want to?
Again, just quickly, Tom O'Connor for the record, Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities. We're very much in support of this bill. As nonprofit entities, as municipalities, we're not eligible for a variety of the tax incentive programs that are out there for these kinds of developments. And so this little bit of help on the feasibility study side would be of help to us, and we do support it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Committee, I think I want to look at this just a little bit closer. To me, it raises some questions that I just want to take some time with. I appreciate the folks coming all the way from Sherman County and elsewhere to testify in favor of the bill, and I expect that we will move it shortly, just not today. Just want to be a little more careful. Committee, anything else for the good of the order? Okay, that closes the public hearing on Senate Bill 834, and this committee is adjourned. Thank you.